Square Dance Convention in San Antonio, having a wonderful time talking with various people. And this afternoon we're talking with Stan Burdick, who is currently from the Lake Placid area of New York State. And the date today is 28th of June, 1996. And we're interested in the Stan Burdick life story. And starting with what happened before square dancing, what got you into it, and what was your greatest influence for people or events and what have you. So, Stan, take off.
Okay. Thanks, Bob. Nice to talk, and always good to reminisce about the good old days, so to speak. I'm happy that I'm now about, well, getting close at least to celebrating 50 years of calling. I figured that I started in late 47, early 48. I've for all intents and purposes, I've put down 1948 as a starting year, because I'm not real sure. But it was in the days of, that I was in college, back in those days, and I went to a dance in a Grange Hall, square dance, and I was so excited about the idea that here was the caller up there. He had everybody in the palm of his hand, so to speak. It was kind of an old-time, what we call Eastern-style dancing, and it would be something like, I think the tune was Listen to the Mockingbird, and I was with a girl. I really did like that girl, and he said, now, first couple, promenade the outside. Go all the way around, and then go into the middle, and swing her if you dare, and then he said, and kiss her if you dare, and by golly, I was waiting for me, the fourth couple, to do that, and promenade, and I just was so enthused about it, but I was a bashful kind of a guy, college days, and I swung her, and when I got into the middle, I swung that girl, but then I didn't dare kiss her, and I kicked myself all the way home. I got to thinking about it, and I thought, you know, I'd like to be in that position there, where you tell people what to do, and they're having fun, and maybe I better learn this kind of thing. Well, time went on. That was 1948.
And where was this, Dan?
That was in a little town in western New York. I went to a college called Alfred University, and I was just a two-year school there, and I was studying various subjects, and that was the beginning of where I saw square dancing, and I wanted to be a part of it.
Yeah, and you were brought up where?
My home originally was Rhode Island, and spent a lot of time in Connecticut and in the New England states, but then I went to college, and the college I went to was in western New York. And I hadn't seen square dancing much in New England, although I knew it was very prevalent there, too. So that was back in 48. And then I decided, well, I've got to learn this stuff. And since my folks were in New England, we were very familiar with the New England area. And so we heard that Charlie Baldwin from Boston, great caller that's not been with us for many years. Charlie Baldwin was running a school for callers along with his Labor Day week in Camp Beckett in the Berkshire Mountains. And what Charlie was doing was every morning he'd take about 20 guys that wanted to learn to call. Weren't any women in it at that time, but 20 guys, and each morning of that week, he would work them on how to call, and I never forget some of the lessons that he taught. One thing was, now, swing and whirl that corner, girl. 1, 2, 3, 4. Promenade, go 2 by 2. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And that's the way Charlie would teach. And he wanted you to get the idea that on those 1, 2, 3, 4, or 1 through 8, you weren't to say anything. He said, you know, to get your timing, you got to either count or tap your foot or something. And that was the beginning. That was when I first began to really learn to call. And, of course, incidentally, I met my wife at Camp Beckett, because she went as a single, I went as a single, and soon after that we were married. But I'd known her before from the work in camps. I worked in the YMCA and worked in camp work, and she was in a neighboring camp, so I knew her before. But that week, that 1 week when we were in Camp Beckett, we really got close. And went on hikes and the trails and all that, and we decided that that was the beginning of a romance in which we eventually culminated in our getting married in 1955. But I'll never forget Charlie and the good time of beginning to learn to call, and that was probably in 1949, and that was really when I started seriously, although I had practiced a little bit in 1948 or even a little earlier than that. All we had in those days, as you know, Bob, was the big 78 records of Breakable, and we certainly broke a bunch of them, and Woodhull and all the other callers of the time. And I would listen to those and listen and practice and try to call everything that caller was saying on the record. And that was the beginning of trying to imitate what I heard on that record. There weren't many records where you had just music that you could use to call, and at least I couldn't find any. I'd listen to those guys call and then practice that way.
Excuse me, can I interject a story about Charlie Baldwin?
Sure.
If you brought him up.
Good.
He was the moderator of a clinic at one of the early New England conventions, and he gave a very good presentation and then opened the floor for questions. And a fellow got up and he said, Charlie, he said, how do you know when a record is worn out? And Charlie, without batting an eye, said, when you start to hear the music coming through from the other side. Go
That's
ahead.
Good. That's good. At working for the YMCA and finding out another place that I could go in the summer, we had a whole month off from the Y in the summer. They gave us that much time as professional Y people. And so I heard about a place called Silver Bay, New York, up on Lake George. And so Kathy and I, when we were about to get married, we said, well, let's go up to Silver Bay. They have a beautiful chapel and a huge campus, 40 buildings. It was the YMCA Conference Center. Let's go up there and get married in that chapel. And that's exactly what we did in 1955. And the nice part of it was this. Right after that, since they knew that we had August off every year from the Y, and in that time I worked both for the Providence Y and then into Connecticut, in Middletown, Connecticut, and had that month off, and Silver Bay needed a caller for the month of August. So I went up, and they liked what I was doing, just simple stuff, and I called, and every August from that point on, with the exception of 2 years, and now that number's, I think this is the 38th year that we're going back and calling for a period in the summer. Now we do it all summer long, every Monday night with square dancing for the guests. There are usually 600 or 800 guests at Silver Bay Resort Conference Center all the time, different conference groups. And so Monday night is the square dance night. And now all summer long we do it. In those days, it was just in August when I had free time to do the calling up there. And the nice thing about it, Bob, was that our family, our three kids, practically grew up there in August at that beautiful resort while I called square dances, and they had a good time in this family center. And so square dancing, really going way back then, was such a boon to me to be able to go up there and have all our meals, all our lodging, just for calling dances and, of course, a little other work that they assigned to us. And Kathy and I both helped with various projects there. But the square dancing was the big thing and always has been. And, of course, we're going back again this summer. Now, Silver Bay is our home. We, after retiring or semi-retiring, about 3 years ago, we said, well, let's leave Ohio, sell our house, and go to the God's country, most beautiful place in the world, in the Adirondack Mountains, Silver Bay on Lake George, and live there. We bought a house, and now that's our permanent retirement home. And, of course, we still call many dances, not only the Monday nights at Silver Bay Conference Center, but also dances around that area in other locations. But I'll tell you a little more of the story. The years following that, in the YMCA, you probably know from being associated with YMCAs that it's a very involved kind of work. They want you not only during the day for your regular work, office work, and so forth, but then practically every night you're assigned to various jobs and so forth. And when kids are free and when adults are free, the Y is booming. Well, that didn't fit in too well with my calling interest. I was always getting in trouble because I planned to go somewhere to call a dance, and then the Y people would say, but I thought you were coming to our meeting on that particular night. And so I got in trouble. And so it got to be so busy after a while, both with the Y, both with the calling. A caller has to make a decision somewhere along the line. Shall I leave this secure full-time work in the Y, with its retirement benefits and everything, and jump into this square dance calling full-time? And along about 66, I had to make that decision. And Kathy and I talked it over, and we said, let's do it. Let's leave the Y and jump into square dancing full-time. It was quite a risk. But then we were lucky again, just plain luck. Along close to that time, 66, 67, I was doing some odd work for people and so forth and calling dances and trying to make a living that way. And along came Arvid Olson, who owned American Squares. It was then called American Squares. And he wasn't the first editor-publisher. Ricky Holden was involved in that thing way back 10 years before in New Jersey. And others were involved as editors, Frank Kaltman and others. So that magazine was going down. I was doing some writing for the magazine because I like to write about square dancing. And so Arvid Olson, the editor, came to me and said, you know, Stan, we're having trouble getting this magazine really sold. I think you could buy this magazine and make a good go of it. And now that you're not working the Y anymore and you have maybe a little more time, you could buy this magazine, make a go of it, build it, and so forth. Well, that sounded good, and we were lucky to get that opportunity. So we got the magazine from Arvid, and we tried to build it up. We changed the name to the New American Squares. Later we changed the name to American Square Dance. And so we built that magazine. You know, the funny thing is, Bob, that Arvid promised us, shouldn't say this on tape, but Arvid promised, you can delete this if you want to. Arvid Olsen promised us that there were about 5,000 subscribers. Okay, so we bought it on the strength of that, and we printed 5,000, maybe over 5,000 copies. Our first big printing in Sandusky, Ohio, 5,000 copies. Well, you know, we had to eat a lot of those copies because Arvid wasn't quite true to his word. Oh, yes, he was in a way. Sure, he had 5,000 names in the file, but some of them he'd carried for years. And so we had a bunch of names, and by the time we culled the files and pulled them all out, the ones that had not been dropped and should have been dropped, we ended up with 1,700 active subscribers to the magazine.
Wow.
Over the years, Bob, we built the magazine all the way up from 1,700 with a lot of work, a lot of traveling around the country, a lot of subscription dances. We built that up to our big total was 24,000 that we finally had, and we were about to sell it. The magazine was sold to John Sanborn in 1992. We were kind of thinking about doing some other things and getting out of the magazine. It had been 23 years that we published that magazine, and it's a lot of work. A lot of constant work, not just 9 to 5, but working nights and all. So John wanted to buy it. And so I think when we sold about 21 or 22,000 is what we had at that point. And so John Sanborn, these last 3-4 years, has been the owner of American Square Dance Magazine. There was something else, though, that I need to mention of historical interest. When Bob Osgood decided that he wanted to take it a little more easy and get out of publishing his magazine, which was, as you know, Square Dancing Magazine, or a lot of people used to say Sets in Order, both names applied. And this was in the early 80s. And Bob came to us and said, Stan and Kathy, would you consider, you're the only ones that I want to rely on to have to pick up our subscribers if we would quit publishing American Square Dance, Sets in Order. And this was, again, a golden opportunity for us, because once you're publishing a magazine and you go to all that trouble of so many pages per month, and then suddenly a bonanza comes like that where you can almost double your subscription and just print the same magazine, but your printer's going to get rich from that because he gets all the gravy. But you will get richer too, because all those new subscribers for your magazine certainly will pay their fair share. We worked a deal with Bob, and it was very equitable, and we certainly appreciated Bob's generosity at this point. He didn't want to lose his subscribers, so we agreed to fulfill all of the unexpired subscriptions if they were willing to take our magazine. He wrote a nice letter to all of them and said, the Burdicks are taking over your unfulfilled subscription. And some dropped at that point. Some said, no, if he's dropping his magazine, we'll drop. So we ended up there close to 24,000 at that point with his and our combined subscriptions. He did not want to let go. He wanted to forever drop the name Sets in Order or Square Dancing Magazine. He didn't want to sell or give that away, and that was fine, but he just simply wanted us to fulfill the subscriptions, and that's exactly what we did. So that was an important year for us to add that many subscribers to our magazine and continue on. At that point, we were at the point where kids' college expenses and all that, it was such a nice boon to have that opportunity. And so that brings us up to 92 when we sold the magazine to John Sandburn. And you know, Bob, you never get printer's ink out of your blood. And so Kathy and I made an agreement with John Sandburn that we would like to print something, and we would not have advertising because that would compete with him, but we'd like to do a caller's note service, just sent to callers. That wouldn't conflict much with what he had in his national magazine. And so we started Mike Side Management in 92 after we'd sold the big magazine, and we've been running that ever since, these 5 years since then. And we're now up to, would you believe, 500 callers, practically every state, every province of Canada, and 10 countries abroad. The callers are subscribing to what we're doing in the note service, and so it's gone very well. And it makes a nice retirement-type opportunity. I'm doing retirement-type things now. We're enjoying life at Silver Bay, and the life is a little easier, but we spend several days every month putting out the Mike Side Management, and I'm calling most every weekend, not so much around the country anymore, but mainly in the areas of New York State, a little in New England and Pennsylvania, close by, that kind of thing. Still doing caller schools, because that's always been a high priority in my life. Still doing seminars and clinics, like the one that I'm working here at San Antonio Convention, and other things of that nature. But I've told Kathy, and in fact told the square dance world, that 50 years is enough. So early 98, I'll not hang up the mic, but I will quit the road pretty much and just call pretty much locally and do these seminar clinic type things, and of course do the note service continually as long as my health holds out.
Well, that's great, Stan. I know you've done many, many miles of traveling, and I'm wondering if you can think of any special accomplishments, any special events that were stick out in your mind that you're very happy that you did or proud that you did, and what about large crowds? Mm-hmm. Did you ever have a dance where nobody showed up?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, many, many times, especially the local areas and breaking into a new area, for instance. And quite, you probably know this, that quite a bit today, there are many caller-run clubs. Years ago, when you and I were so active in the old days, every club seemed to be run by dancers, right, and officers and all that. Well, today, many times, callers are running their own groups and clubs and workshops, and so I'm into that. And so, you see, there are going to be times when you announce a dance and you'll run it and you don't have a bunch of dancers behind you, and suddenly you're there at the hall and nobody comes. So that's certainly an important thing to consider. The other thing about memories and travels and so forth. For 20 trips we've taken now with dancers to other countries and on shipboard and overseas and so forth. And our last one was just this past April, going to Italy and taking 16 dancers and dancing in Rome with the little club there, the only club that we know of in Italy. That's Western style. And then the dancing in London, calling in London, and we've been there a number of times. But these 20 tours have been really important to us. Now I just spread the word about the magazine and to spread the word about square dancing in general, but just to enjoy having fun on cruises and trips with dancers. We've gone to, I'll never forget, square dancing on the Great Wall of China, square dancing in the middle of Shanghai, where those Chinese, thousands of them, gathered, pulled in closer and closer, so close to us that where our little one set could hardly move because they all crowded in with their big smiles and watching us dance. And one little Chinese gentleman off to the side was heard to say in perfect English, "Just like the cowboys do." And that's what his impression was of square dancing. And I don't know if we made any converts there, but it was certainly fun to travel and do this kind of thing. And also dancing in the wilds of Kenya, Africa, 50 miles from nowhere. They take you out on these safaris and you go out into the wilds 50 miles from anywhere. And all you see as you square dance on those rough plains, just for the fun, to entertain ourselves and to entertain our guides, all you see for all the way around the ring as you look, way out there, half a mile out, are antelopes, elephants, giraffes, and all kinds of wild animals watching and wondering what the heck those funny people are doing out in the middle of nowhere in our country, you know. And those are some of the memories that happened from many trips. I guess the biggest dance I ever called was almost accidental. Three callers were involved one year in Louisville, Kentucky, at one of the big festivals there. You know, this goes back 10, 15 years. And the other two callers that were assigned wanted to call in the advanced hall, and I was left in the big hall, and I called, would you believe, a dance for 2 hours with 5,000 dancers. Now, that's when we could get 5,000 dancers in those big arenas in the big cities, and I think that's the most I ever called for, a single dance for 5,000 people. And, you know, you look over those heads, and you can't even see the faces back at the far end of the arena because they're so small. All you can see is the color. And we all wish that the numbers would be like that today. But on the other hand, that's not to complain. We certainly have big crowds in some areas, especially at the national conventions, but not quite that big usually at the smaller festivals.
Yeah, I noticed the total attendance that I read today was 16,337.
Mm-hmm.
And quite a few. I was impressed by the number of Japanese I've seen around
yes.
the convention this year.
Yeah, a bunch of them, you bet.
Well, Stan, I know you've attended many, many national conventions, and tell us about that and a little bit more about Color Lab.
Okay, glad to do that. Well, I think the last count was about 30 national conventions that I've attended. Kathy's gone with me most of the time. I've attended all of the the Caller Lab events, all the conventions of Caller Lab, and of course all of the every other year Legacy has their convention. I've attended all of those. Kathy and I were chairman of Legacy for a period. Actually, speaking of Legacy, I was one of the three responsible for starting Legacy. Bob Osgood came to me and Charlie Baldwin and said, you know, we three are the editors of the three biggest magazines, and so I'm coming to you to see if we couldn't do something, start an organization that would help to do a little bit of control with what's happening that I'm seeing in square dancing, where there are a lot of so-called detours. I remember Bob liked that word, detours, and Bob Osgood would say, you know, look at the situation now. They're coming to the National Convention in hot pants. Can you imagine that? And the women are not dressing properly in good square dance outfits. That's one detour. And I see something else coming in. There's some drinking at some of the dances. And maybe we could start an organization that would try to do something to, not necessarily to control in a dictatorial way, but just to put some regulations in there. And so then we talked and had several meetings where we discussed this, and finally the idea of Legacy came, and that was about 1963 was when we had our first excuse me, I may have that date wrong, 1973 was our first Legacy conference in Cleveland, Ohio. As far as Caller Lab is concerned, I also served a short term there as the executive or chairman, I guess we called it chairman at that point, of Caller Lab following Bob Osgood. And with the magazine and all, at that time it was just impossible to carry on any longer than that short year. And so another chairman or executive was found at that point. Very soon, John Kaltenthaler was found, and John became the regular full.